Marjorie's handling the orientation for the new interns, and I am taking over for tonight for her. My name is Charlene Squires again, one of the managers in cybersecurity department. Today is October 19, 2023, and it is right now 8:01 Eastern Standard Time. Okay, so next on the list is Kyle. The importance of professional networking in IT. Sounds great, Kyle. So, are you around, Kyle?
Yeah, I'm here.
Ready? Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay. Go ahead. I have it recording, so you can go ahead and do your presentation.
All right, one sec.
Oh, I'll mute me so you don't have to listen to me.
Sorry, I haven't presented before, so I'm trying to figure out how I do this.
That's fine. Go ahead and bring up your presentation on your computer and then hit share in the Teams app.
Okay.
Do you have any kind of audio that comes with your presentation?
No, it's just that I have it in the drive, so I can try to grab it from there.
So if you bring it up on your main screen and then you want to click on share for the Teams meeting or Teams application for the meeting. Do you want me to come back to you, Kyle?
Think I
You think you
got
got it?
it,
Okay.
maybe. Did it pop up?
Not yet.
Okay.
You might have to share the you have to find the screen or the window, maybe the window. Check on your window. 'Cause you can share screens or windows with
Okay.
Teams. And I saw your hand, Austin.
If you want, you can go ahead and go to the next person while I check this out.
Oh, okay. Fine. Austin.
Wait, hold on. Did that work?
Oh, I think it did. Yes. It's on the screen if you want to go ahead and present. And
Sure.
then we can come back to Austin. Okay. Ready?
Cool. I think so.
Okay, good. Have
Okay,
at it. Have at it, Kyle.
today my topic's professional networking in the world of information technology. It's something I'm sure we've all heard that's really important for us to do. I haven't really heard a lot of why it's important or the best way to go forward with it. So that's kind of my focus. Who am I? I'm Kyle. I'm a PGIP Tech cybersecurity analyst. So what is professional networking? It's a good idea to get an understanding of how we define it. And in essence, it's just the building of a mutually beneficial relationship. And that mutually beneficial part's really important because something I struggle with when I first started building relationships like this was the idea that it was almost manipulative because I came at it with the idea of like, well, I need something from this person, but I don't know what I can offer to them. And you want to build these relationships in connection to your field and the fields that are around that. Now, why is it important? Like, why should we do this? The initial one is career development. That's something that we've all heard it in context too. You know, we're going to find job opportunities from the people that we are working with, the people we connect to. You know, I've seen it on LinkedIn a lot of times. I'll see someone post a job opportunity that they found interesting, but wasn't quite a good fit for them. And it might be for someone else. Clients and candidates to hire are another good one. But the main thing, like the strongest point, is collaboration. The idea of building these networks isn't just, you know, what do I get from it? But it's from, you know, how can I use this network to develop a team or answer questions or pretty much build yourself, build what your projects are. And that comes in, you know, sharing advice and resources. And mentorships is another good one. An example that I came across was like Stuxnet. What we know now about the Stuxnet virus didn't come from one professional. It came from the collaboration of several organizations, several people, and the actual creation of the virus itself wasn't just one organization. You know, it was Israel and the US as far as we know. And where do you start? That's kind of like the hardest part, is getting your foot into it. The best place would be social media. It's probably the easiest place to start. And I've seen it not too long ago where we had a chain of LinkedIn links for everyone to go through and join up with each other. You know, that's a great opportunity. You know, look for, you know, people in your teams that you're working with now. You know, make those connections and keep them around. Industry leaders is another good one. You know, they have pages on LinkedIn where other people are following them. They're going to post content. They'll post jobs. That's a big plus. And content creators too, podcasters. And like with Try Hack Me, for example, there's a lot of people that go through and they'll do walkthroughs and make videos on YouTube and stuff. And you can find people commenting on those videos that are going to be interested in the same things that you are. And if you want to go to like physical events, like conventions, workshops, that kind of stuff, it's another great way, because all the people that you're going to be surrounded by are going to be people that are interested in the things you're interested in. And, you know, keep in mind, like your friends, family, just people in public, you never know who you're going to run into. And how do you build these relationships? It's sometimes a challenge to get them started. Sometimes joining an organization and reaching out to people on social media. You know, when you go into these situations, come into it with goals in mind. Like, what are you looking to get out of this relationship? And share how your goals and how theirs can work with each other. And don't be afraid to show that you're passionate about it. And then once you've made that connection, you're going to want to stay in touch. You know, it's a lot of work making that initial connection. And then to just let it fade away into nothing, it doesn't do you a whole lot of good. So start conversations with these people that you're interacting with. It's sometimes as simple as asking what's new. You know, talk about accomplishments. If you might see someone post about a challenge, don't be afraid to interact and ask about it. Maybe even give some insight. I have some really weird situations that I've come across that kind of demonstrates just how building these networks can happen anywhere. You know, I was on vacation in a small town in Washington, in Leavenworth, if you guys have ever been, where I just saw someone wearing a shirt that talked about, you know, the difference between a scope during a pen test and during an actual attack. And we laughed about it, you know, struck up conversation with him. And, you know, he ended up giving me some really good advice and leads on content for studying for the CompTIA exams. You know, on the same vacation, I was relaxing in a hot tub, just happened to run into someone who worked with, you know, a cloud industry. And we talked about that for a while. You know, there's just riding motorcycle. You know, I was practicing some exercises, had some other people join in with me. And it turned out one of them was a network engineer who was planning on transferring over to sales. And he wanted to build his network so that when he finally got into sales, he could reach out, you know, and try to sell software. And his idea was that if you could help people get into jobs, they might be a little more willing to listen to a sales offer. And then another one was a wedding. You know, I just happened to be at a friend's wedding. They're not into tech at all. And came across someone who was. And he even offered to put in a good word if I wanted to apply at his place of work. So when you're thinking about this stuff, it really can just come from anywhere, but it takes some effort on your part to make it grow into more than just happenstance. And if you're curious about where I got some of this information, it's right here. And I think that about does it.
Great. Kyle, that was wonderful information. I even get intimidated by just talking to strangers, you know, and it's kind of nice that, you know, you can find people everywhere doing something with technology. So yeah. Do we have any questions for Kyle? Anyone have questions? It's a great topic, by the way. And I love your cartoons. That was wonderful.
Thanks. I had a quick question. Do you know how I close this now?
Yeah, it's just exit, stop sharing.
Oh, there it is. Perfect. Is Austin raising his hand to ask a question?
Hi, Austin. Do you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Wonderful. Okay, I just want to say, Kyle, that was a great presentation. Also, I wanted to check if my mic was working, but that was a really good presentation.
It was excellent.
Thank you. I will pass it off to the next person then.
Okay, so Austin, Charlie, are you ready? Oh, Kayla.
Someone else, Christy, was asking who was presenting after Kyle.
Oh, I was going to go back to Austin since he was the first on the list.
Okay, I think she heard you. Thank you.
All right. You're welcome. Austin, are you ready to present?
I am ready. Do I just hit the share button?
Yes. Share your screen. And do you have any audio?
I don't have any audio. Do you guys see it?
Perfect. I can see it, so you're good to go.
All right. So my presentation. Oh, hello, everybody. My presentation is going to be about web design, basically talking about HTML5 and CSS, the coding languages. All right. The first slide is going to be what is HTML5? So let me grab my notes. Firstly, we will look into HTML5. HTML, standing for Hypertext Markup Language, is the building block of all websites. You can think of it as the skeletal structure for our online world. It allows us to structure our websites and define content like texts, images, videos, and more. The number 5 in HTML5 represents it as the 5th and current version of HTML. It introduces a set of new elements, attributes, and behaviors, as well as a larger set of technologies that allows us to build more diverse and powerful websites and applications. HTML5 is now universally supported on all browsers, making it a pivotal sorry, making it pivotal in standardizing the way we interact and create on the web. In conclusion, HTML5 is our present and future in building and navigating the internet. Next slide is going to be CSS. In the previous slide, we were speaking of HTML5. CSS works, CSS can be considered the skin and clothes of the website, which works well with HTML5, determining the look and the feel. It's CSS that provides the color, the layout, the fonts, and the animations you see on the websites. CSS works hand in hand with HTML. While HTML structures the content, CSS is used to format structured content. It separates a document's structure from its presentation, which has several benefits, such as improved content accessibility, flexibility, and control in the specification of presentational characteristics, and reduced complexity and redundancy in the structural content. In a layman's terms, HTML lays out the foundation of the website, when CSS comes in to make it visually appealing and user-friendly. Together, they create interactive, functional, and a beautiful website. Moving on to the next slide, we'll discuss the symbiotic relationship between HTML5 and CSS, as we now know that HTML5 provides the structure of the pages, and CSS is used to style these structures. Combining the two, HTML5 and CSS, we can not only devise but also decorate our web projects. Think of HTML5 as a sketch pad and CSS as the set of colors and brushes. HTML5 helps draft the outline of elements such as headers, paragraphs, links, and so forth, grounding our outline on the World Wide Web, literally and figuratively speaking. Then CSS steps in to color and style these objectives. It specifies the layout, the vibrant or monochromatic color schemes, fancy fonts, and interesting animations to truly bring our sketch to life. Together, HTML5 and CSS formulate a more interactive, dynamic, and responsive user experience by separating the website's content from its design. We can manage, amend, and optimize them independently and improve the overall efficiency of web development. Next slide, I'm just going to show you an example of the skeletal structure. I'll go over it in the next slide. Basically, we've got the doc type, the header, the title of the page, close off the header. We got a body. It's where the body and everything goes, where the paragraph can go. Close the body, and then close the HTML. Now we're going to define the structure. So doc type, basically, you're declaring the declaration to use HTML5. It basically informs the browser that this document is the HTML5 document. And with the closing HTML, it basically closes off the command. The title defines the title of the web page where we would write on the top. H1 is a heading tag. You can tell by the H1. There's also an H2, H3, and so on. Paragraph tag, which is the P, where you can write the content. And then a slash at the end of the HTML and all the others and signals the end of the code. Now we got an example of the CSS basic structure. All right, now we're going to define the structure. So basically the body sets the background color of the entire page. The H1, like the HTML5, is a header style. The color settings change the text color, and the text align property centers the text. P styles all paragraph elements. The font family property changes the font, and the font size property sets the size of the text. All right. The benefits of using HTML5 and CSS in web design. So, for the first, we got the enhanced user experience. HTML5 and CSS enable the creation of dynamic and interactive web pages, improving user engagement. It's cross-platform compatibility. The websites built with HTML5 and CSS are compatible with various different devices and browsers, ensuring a consistent experience for users. Improved SEO, search engine optimization. Properly structured HTML5 and CSS code can enhance the website's visibility in search engines, driving organic or human traffic to your site. Mobile responsiveness. With HTML5 and CSS, it is easier to build responsive websites that adapt to different screen sizes and mobile devices, enhancing the user experience. Clean code and maintenance. HTML5 and CSS promote clean, structured code, making it easier to maintain and update your website in the long run. I will also say that working with HTML5 and CSS myself, I found it easier than most of the other languages to learn. Styling flexibility. CSS allows for precise and control over design elements, enabling creativity and visually appealing web pages. All right, so conclusion. To wrap up this presentation on HTML5 and CSS, let's take a moment to reflect on what we've covered. We have explored the fundamentals of HTML5, understanding its role as structural framework of web pages. We learned about the new elements and capabilities introduced in HTML5, allowing us to create dynamic and engaging websites. Next, we delved into CSS and its complementary relationship with HTML5. CSS empowers us to design and style web pages, adding visual appeal, creating layouts, and enhancing user experience. By combining HTML5 and CSS, we leveraged the strengths of both languages to create stunning, functional, and adaptable websites that cater to the needs of modern users. Throughout our journey, we have seen the benefits of both CSS and HTML5 in the web design, from the semantic structure and accessibility improvements to multimedia support and SEO friendliness. These technologies offer a robust foundation for building compelling online experiences. As you continue to explore web development, remember to keep honing your skills in HTML5 and CSS. These languages will continue to evolve, and staying up to date with the latest standards and best practices will help you create innovative and captivating web experience. Thank you, everybody. That is the end. Any questions?
That was wonderful, Austin.
Thank you.
Good job. That was good. Makes you wonder, when you open a web page, they have the CSS right or not. Sometimes it looks kind of funky, so you never know.
Many times you can actually see the code from a web page as well.
I know. I've done it off. Accidentally. It's like, oh no, what did I press? But yes, it's very interesting. Any questions for Austin, guys? Everyone's being very quiet tonight. Okay, moving on then. But that was a good presentation. Both you and Kyle did really wonderful. Okay, our next presenter is, let me find my list. All right, we have Christy Martinez next on health.
Actually, Christy? Can I go last? My computer is acting really funky right now.
Oh, sure. No problem. So we'll call on the next one. Let's see, we have Rebecca Martinez. Is she here? Rebecca? Let's see. Rebecca, I don't see Rebecca. Let me look. See more. Rebecca. Nope, I don't see Rebecca. All right, so we'll move on then. Nick Shelton, are you ready? Is Nick here?
Yeah.
I thought I saw him.
Okay. Give me a second. I'm trying to pull it up.
Oopsie.
All right. Can everybody see that?
Oh, where are you?
All right. Some organic chemistry.
Yes. So, how about it? Sounds good, Nick.
All right. So I'm doing my presentation on graphene and the different innovations that it's brought about. Semiconductors and innovation. A semiconductor material falls between conductors and insulators, regulating the electric current within electronic devices. This makes it a very widely used element in electronic chips, including solid-state storage devices, among other things. Semiconductors are an essential component of electronic devices, enabling advances in communications, computing, healthcare, military systems, transportation, clean energy, and countless other applications. Silicon semiconductors enabled the growth of computers and were arguably the greatest surge in information technology since the printing press. Where did graphene come from? Well, in 2004, two scientists from the University of Manchester, Andrei Game and Konstantin Novoselov, discovered graphene while playing with a graphite block and tape. In 2010, they shared the Nobel Prize in Physics for the discovery of graphene that day. The researchers used various techniques, including electron and Raman spectroscopy to confirm the structure and properties of the isolated graphene. The discovery of graphene was significant because it opened a new field of research and led to the exploration of its extraordinary properties and potential applications in various industries, including electronics, material science, and more. A single layer of carbon atoms arranged in a hexagonal lattice may appear humble, but its potential knows no bounds. What is graphene? Well, found a short video to help
explain it. The Simple Show explains graphene. This is graphene. Let's call him Mr. G. He is the first material that is two-dimensional. This gives him a unique set of properties. Since 1859, many scientists were looking for graphene using complex experiments. But the first crystals of graphene were discovered in 2004 using a very simple and effective method, namely ordinary scotch tape. During Friday evening experiments in Manchester, scientists noticed small parts of graphene on the tape used to clean a graphite stone. The two scientists, Andrew Geim and Konstantin Novoselov, were awarded with the Nobel Prize in Physics 2010 for this simple but groundbreaking experiment. Thanks to the scotch tape method, this area of science grew extremely quickly. And today, hundreds of laboratories all over the world deal with different aspects of G research. What makes Mr. G a really super material is the combination of his unique properties. G is the first 2D crystal ever known to us, the thinnest object ever obtained, and also the lightest one. G is the world's strongest material, harder than diamond, and about 300 times stronger than steel. G conducts electricity much better than copper. G is a transparent material. G is bendable and can take any form you want. And this unique supermaterial gave birth to a new class of crystals that are also just one atom thin. And what's more fantastic is that these can be shuffled with each other to engineer new materials on demand to meet the special needs of different industries. All these factors move graphene swiftly from the G Research Laboratory to the G Marketplace, driven by demand from industries where such supermaterials are required: aerospace, automotive, electronics, energy storage, coatings and paints, communications, sensor, solar, oil, and etc. Thanks to mass production methods intensively being developed, expect to meet Mr. G in person soon.
All right. And the properties of graphene, since they didn't get too in-depth with it in there, it is, well, they said about 300 times stronger, but it varies. It's roughly 100 times stronger than steel and stiffer than diamond. As far as electrical, it is a 60% greater conductivity than copper. Thermal, it has a 5% conductivity of AI. Lubricating, it has a very low surface shear. It's impermeable, vacuum tight to helium gas, which is very hard to find. Transparent, it's almost 98% clear for optical transmission. Some of the graphene innovations used today are biosensors. Picture a slender, crisp, seamlessly integrated into your bloodstream, continuously tracking your health metrics and even communicating with your brain to identify potential health risks. Some of those are in development still, but some of them are being used already. Photonics. With the integration of graphene, chips sensitive to light could experience a significant boost in their responsiveness, potentially leading to groundbreaking advancements in photonic devices such as cameras, medical imaging equipment, and more. This has already been used across many fields as far as cameras and medical imaging equipment especially. One that surprised me was it's also used in water filtration. A derivative of graphene known as graphene oxide exhibits great potential in the field of water purification. Whether it's the removal of impurities or the desalination of seawater, graphene could very well be the champion of clean water in our future. Graphene can also be used to make batteries. Lithium ion batteries are a commonly used battery today due to their high energy storage and density, but they do have a flaw. One issue that lithium ion batteries continue to have is safety. The liquid contained within a lithium ion battery is flammable. For example, in 2016, a sudden burst of smartphones caused first degree burns to several users worldwide. I actually had one of those phones and they recalled them. It was a big ordeal. Graphene's bonds provide it with over four times the tensile strength of steel, all while maintaining remarkable transparency, flexibility, and outstanding electrical and thermal conductivity. These attributes position graphene as a promising contender for not just batteries, but also supercapacitors. Nevertheless, graphene supercapacitors, despite their rapid charge capability, fall short in terms of energy storage compared to traditional batteries. But to address this limitation, researchers have embarked on the development of a hybrid energy storage systems that combine the strengths of both supercapacitors and batteries relating to graphene. I started to get into these, and I just kind of made a very simple form because each one of these is pretty involved. But as graphene continues to become more understood, many of the different hybrid batteries have also been discovered. Among them are a graphene aluminum hybrid battery, graphene enhanced lithium sulfur battery, graphene enhanced polymer battery, and a graphene non-flammable lithium ion battery or Li battery. If you want to look any of these up on your own, you can, but they all go fairly in depth and they're all developed for a specific purpose. Some have pros and cons to different applications. Some other possibles made possible today by graphene. Aerospace materials. Graphene reinforced materials are being explored for use in aerospace components, potentially reducing weight and improving fuel efficiency. Anti-theft devices. embedded into a sticker to avoid detection by thieves. The chips can be made flat thanks to graphene. Many people see them. I know I saw them before, but I never knew what they were actually made out of. Coatings and paints. Graphene coatings provide protective and anti-corrosion properties for various materials, expanding their lifespan. You can buy graphene nano coating spray, just like the one pictured, right from Amazon. They have different ones to polish all different types of things, from the rims on your car to, you know, anything that you'd want to polish, pretty much. Flexible electronics. Graphene can be used in flexible displays and wearable technology and bendable electronic devices. And bulletproof vests. Since graphene is such a strong and lightweight material, it has been added to bulletproof vests to make them more effective as well. One of the more fascinating things that I saw when I was looking into it was a quantum ruler that they were able to develop. A single layer of carbon atoms, the astonishing material called graphene, possesses remarkable properties. Yet the intrigue deepens when you stack multiple sheets of graphene. When two or more graphene layers are slightly misaligned, exhibiting subtle twists relative to each other, they manifest a multitude of fascinating characteristics. Depending on the degree of the twist, these materials, referred to as moire quantum matter, can spontaneously create their magnetic fields, transform into superconductors with zero electrical resistance, or in contrast, transition into complete insulators. The exact opposite. Joseph A. Strascio and his colleagues at the NIST, along with an international team of collaborators, have developed a quantum ruler to measure and explore the strange properties between these twisted materials. The work may also lead to new miniaturized standard for electrical resistance that could calibrate electronic devices directly on the factory floor, eliminating the need to send them to offsite standards laboratory. Everybody might not be aware, but in some industries, certain machines have to be fine-tuned a lot, and they can't calibrate them on site, so they actually have to pay to ship them somewhere else and then have them calibrated and then sent back. And there's also laboratory equipment that's the same way. This would eliminate the need for that and could potentially allow them to calibrate everything on site. And the picture here describes or shows more the different magnetic fields that can be created just by the overlaying sheets. When you slightly move them, it can create a different electric field. Almost looks like an egg carton. Graphene in the future. What makes graphene so extraordinary? It's the epitome of human achievement. Strong yet flexible, transparent, conductive, lightweight yet resilient. Graphene's properties seem contradictory, but they are the embodiment of what innovation truly means. It defies conventional wisdom and opens doors to many new possibilities. The future of graphene largely depends on ongoing research, innovation, and commercialization efforts. As scientists continue to explore its properties and applications, we can expect new and exciting breakthroughs that will shape various industries and our everyday lives. The journey of graphene, from its discovery to its integration into practical applications, is not going to end anytime soon. And those are my references.
Great job, Nick. Wow, that is awesome. I wonder if they did the egg test on it.
I'm not sure.
Because then, you know, would they be, you know, good enough for it to, you know, be flexible? Well, I talked about being flexible. I thought, well, being flexible with an egg, you know, to, you know, you can soften the blow of the egg or prevent it from breaking.
Yeah, I wonder if it's ever been used in those egg drop experiments that they do.
I know, I don't know. You never know.
You can buy graphene tape relatively cheap now.
Oh. That'd be taking some interest, interesting applications with that.
Yeah, I'd heard the name before. Well,
Slendon.
Yeah, there's even more applications because all that, you know, the graphene is just a hexagonal carbon close packing 2D, and then they stack it upon, and it's the van der Waals radii that actually, when you stack them on top, actually gives a strength. So I had a question about when they're using it in batteries, are they using it in between the conductive elements to hold the charge?
That was one way. From what I was reading, there were so many different variations. They're working as using it as the semiconductor, and then using it as an insulator. And then there were some where they tried to use it in all aspects, just by varying the different degree and angle.
Straight graphene is not going to conduct very well.
Yeah, exactly.
And by the way, this is, you roll this up and you got nanotubes, by the way.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. The more I started to look into it, there's a whole new field too that a lot of companies are getting into, like borophene, and it just went way too far for a short presentation. So I kind of tried to keep it focused on just graphene.
If you go from a six hexagonal pack to a pentapack five, you can get buckyballs out of this.
I'm definitely going to continue researching, because I didn't realize all that was in it. I had heard the term before, but.
Oh, yeah. This is your basic, well, not basic. It is organic chemistry because it's carbon.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be the building block that, yeah, we're going to see a lot of crazy inventions.
Silicon, which we use all the time, has very similar chemistry. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, a lot of applications on those. So great job on that.
Thanks.
I appreciate that. I like science somewhat, but to a point anyway, but it's very good.
I had a couple slides that were all breakdown of the batteries and different elements and resistors, and it would have been too much.
Yeah,
he could have got into sp2 orbitals and double bonds and so forth.
Not that detailed, please.
I purposely tried to find a simplized video to explain it for me so that I wouldn't go too.
Well, I did like that G guide. That was pretty nice. Explain
it's crazy
what
that video
graphene
is.
The
video is actually from 8 years ago, so a lot more developments have even come out. That was a very dumbed down version, but yeah. Gives the idea.
Well, I like the idea, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's go down our list. Rebecca, are you available?
I'm here. Mine's recording because I have the baby with me.
Okay. All right. So what you could do is play your slides and recording together, and then after we have questions, then you can be online, right?
Sorry, I didn't realize I was mic'd, so, but yes, that's fine. I'll pull it up right now.
Go ahead and do it.
Hello, my name is Rebecca Martinez, an aspiring cloud administrator. I'd like to welcome everyone here and thank you for listening to my presentation. My topic today regards something that has been done for over 10,000 years by humans. I will not be discussing the ethical or moral views of the topic, but instead focusing on the process and the technology that is used or could be used in the process. Next slide, please. Okay, so what are domesticated animals? A domesticated animal is an animal that was selectively bred and then genetically adapted over generations to live alongside humans. Scientists believe the dog was the first animal to be domesticated, but it is not confirmed. Some traits that make good candidates for domestication include they grow and mature quickly, they breed easily, they have a plant-based diet, meaning they are inexpensive to feed, they're hardy and easily adapt to changing environments, and they live in herds or had ancestors that lived in herds, which make them easier to control. There are three main groups that domesticated animals fall under: companion, food, or work. Those classifications are quite broad, and I'm sure you're already thinking about various animals that fit in those categories. Next slide, please. Companion animals. Companion animals, put simply, are pets. Common pets include cats, dogs, fish, small mammals, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. But these are not all considered domesticated animals. Remember, a domesticated animal is one that has been monitored and specific traits were selected and made to reproduce, causing the current animal to be drastically different from their wild ancestors. Cats, dogs, ferrets, and hamsters are examples of pets that have been domesticated. Reptiles and amphibians are examples of pets that have not. Food animals. Livestock, like cattle, sheep, turkeys, pigs, and goats, are examples of the domesticated animal group that is farmed for food. Food animals are not necessarily all eaten, but can produce something that is eaten or used. Examples of these livestock products include meat, eggs, milk, fur, leather, wool, and honey. Yes, honey! Bees are domesticated animals or semi-domesticated animals, as their genetics are largely controlled by human breeders instead of nature. Work animals. Beasts of burden or working animals are domesticated and trained by humans to perform tasks instead of being slaughtered and harvested for animal products. Sorry if that was a little graphic. Depending on the animal will depend on the use. Some can be used for their strength, like oxen, or transportation, like camels. Others can execute specialized tasks, like messenger pigeons. Yes, messenger pigeons are indeed still around. Cool example. A unique example of a working animal is the fishing cormorant. Trained cormorants catch fish in rivers for the fishermen that train them, and this style of fishing has been used in China, Japan, Greece, Macedonia, England, and France. This style of fishing has been done for over 1,300 years. Cultural differences. Culture is a huge part of where an animal falls in the classification system. I'll use an example to help you visualize it. The domestic goat, or Caprohircus, if you want to use their binomial name, had an ancestor, the Bezoar ibex. Pretty sure I said that wrong, but it's okay. Which, after a recent molecular study, is suggested to have been initially domesticated in West Asia over 10,000 years ago. Goats serve many purposes depending on the culture or the location they live in. In a society that views them as companion animals, they are used as loving pets. As food animals, their milk, meat, fiber, skin, horns, vellum, and even manure are all used. Vellum is prepared animal skin and membrane, by the way. As a working animal, they are used as guards, fighting, racing, lawn mowing, weed control, clearing land, and in shows. Goats are pretty impressive, right? Next slide, please. History of domesticated pets. Excuse me. Thanks to a jawbone found in Iraq, scientists believe dogs were domesticated over 14,000 years ago. Dogs have been domesticated for a long time and have had multiple changes based on the selective breeding humans put them through, creating new breeds with specific traits and qualities. Ancient pets. Romans preferred their dogs to have specific colors based on their occupation. Shepherd dogs were bred white so they wouldn't look like wolves at night. farmyard dogs were black to scare away thieves. The common cat descended from five different types of wildcat and are thought to have been first domesticated around 7,500 BC. Although primarily used as companion animals, they also served a purpose controlling mice and rat infestations. Ancient farm animals. The first animals domesticated specifically for food are thought to be sheep. They were first domesticated somewhere between 11,000 and 9,000 BC in Southwest Asia, with goats following behind around 8,000 BC. They were primarily domesticated by nomadic communities and were an integral part of the livelihood as they were used for their meat, milk, and coats. More settled communities around the same time period also domesticated pigs and cattle, which allowed their population to grow as through the domestication process, they were able to increase the farming, which in turn increased humans' capacity to feed larger populations. Unique animals. Elephants. Although never truly tamed, were domesticated and served humans in India as early as 2000 BC. Females were commonly used for domestication purposes, as their males were harder to control. The males did have their role, however. They were trained for war and used for intimidation. Next slide, please. The domestication process. The domestication process can simply be broken down into three steps. 1. Capture the animal. 2. Tame the animal through breeding and training. 3. Obtain useful materials from them, put them to work. Or, the more modern step, let them sleep on your bed and eat your food. Although the topic is interesting, I'm sure you were thinking, where's the technology? Don't worry, it's finally time to talk about the tech. Technology is used in each of the various steps of the domestication process. Next slide, please. Okay, so now we're looking at search and select the animal. The first step to capturing an animal for domestication is selecting it. It is estimated that around 8.7 million species populate our planet, 86% of all species on land and 91% in the oceans have yet to be discovered. Traditional methods used to track biodiversity include camera traps and aerial surveys. Camera traps connect digital cameras to infrared sensors to capture images and videos of animals that move past the sensors. An aerial survey is a method of collecting geomatics or other imagery via airplanes, helicopters, UAVs, balloons, or other methods. The data collected can include photography, LIDAR or leader, remote sensing, and geophysical data. Artificial intelligence is being integrated into the traditional methodology, my apologies, to create improved ways of analyzing large amounts of conservation data to improve wildlife identification and monitoring. Certain AI analyzes data from the camera traps, satellite and drone images, as well as audio and video recordings. A nonprofit called WildMe created a cloud-based platform, WildBook, that uses computer vision and deep learning algorithms to scan millions of crowdsourced wildlife images, identifying species and individual animals based on their unique patterns and physical features. This picture with the zebras and the giraffes shows the Northern Kenyan landscape with scene labeling AI technology developed by WildMe. Next slide, please. Further AI info collection, branching off our previous slide, this is to show the curve rank algorithm of a whale's tail, showing the technology of how it scans and identifies the whale coming, the whale's tail out of the water. Now, a whale's tail is composed of two lobes, each of which is called a fluke. WildMe uses a curve rank algorithm applied to the whale fluke to identify the whale. Through open source software, it's possible to use this non-invasive method to track various species. Although these technologies are not currently used for domesticating animals, it is possible to see the benefits of these techniques in the domestication process. Tame the animal. After selecting and acquiring the animal, the next steps are breeding the animals based on the traits and features you want. Next slide, please. Breeding. Breeding programs have become more advanced with time. Reproductive technologies, including artificial insemination, a very different type of AI, and embryo transfer are two reproductive techniques that enhance the genetic improvement of livestock breeds. Artificial insemination and embryo transfer are two reproductive technologies which enhance the genetic improvement of livestock breeds. As opposed to the conventional breeding programs, artificial insemination allows genetically superior males to produce a large number of highly productive offspring. Embryo transfers allows a genetically superior female to do the same more efficiently. Sperm sexing. Another form of technology used is called sperm sexing, which results in the physical separation of the Y chromosome bearing sperm that produces male offspring from an X chromosome bearing one, which produces female offspring. With this technology, it is possible to determine the newborn animal sex with an accuracy rate of between 85 and 95%. This technology is currently used for beef cattle farmers to produce more males for meat production, and dairy cattle farmers use it to have more females for milk production. Genetic testing. Genetic testing is another method which allows researchers to examine the genetic makeup of an animal to locate DNA segments with single nucleotide polymorphism, or SNP. SNP is a short piece of DNA where there is only one nucleotide that differs across animals. The information acquired from a group of SNPs is able to be used to calculate genomically. Practice this like seven times. Still can't say it right. Enhanced estimated breeding values. The information is then used to help breeders select animals with greater productivity potential, as well as help identify recessive genes that affect an animal's fertility and overall health. Next slide, please. Genetic editing. Genome editing is used on various plant and animal breeds due to the precise genetic changes it is able to accomplish. It is a faster way of developing animals with more desirable genetic combinations compared to the conventional breeding process, which was used in the past. This technology induces a controlled, intentional change in a fertilized egg using a naturally occurring gene by a specific natural occurring enzyme system. Some genome editing tools include, now bear with me on this, these are kind of hard for me to say, clustered regularly interspaced short palindromic repeats, or CRISPR, transcription activator-like effector nucleuses, or TALENs, and zinc finger nucleuses, ZFNs. The genome edited cattle in the past few years have shown improved health, welfare, and increased productivity. Training. In this stage, training an animal is also important. Depending on the animal will depend on the training methods. For example, dogs have various types of training mechanisms used to improve the efficiency of their training. Training collars are very popular in teaching obedience and basic skills. Cameras are used to watch the animal while they aren't home, and many have two-way communication functions to allow someone to speak to their dog. An even more advanced version has a built-in treat dispenser that can all be used through a phone application. Sonic frequency sound waves, which the dogs find unpleasant, is used to deter unwanted behavior. Anti-barking technology depends on the type, but can include devices you carry, sound-emitting collars, and even barking control centers in the home. Next slide, please. Fun fact! North Carolina State University researchers developed a customized suite of technologies to allow a computer to train a dog autonomously by having the computer respond to the dog based on the dog's body language. They utilized sensors in custom dog harnesses to monitor the dog's posture, and the computer reinforced correct behavior by quickly and consistently. The technology integrated the fundamental principles of animal learning into the computational system. Next slide, please. Use the animal. In the third step, you are using the animal based on the intended purposes of the domestication, depending on if the animal was meant to be used as a companion, for food, or work. Will depend on the final step. Food group. The food group is interesting because there is a ton of technology being used at all levels, directly on the animal during the transportation of goods and the act of taking those base goods and making them consumable. Just milk. Automatic milking systems are an example of how technology is used to increase productivity in the milking process of a cow. Cows are milked using vacuum cups that attach to their teats. The milk is sent through stainless steel pipes to large refrigerated vats. Within 48 hours, the milk is taken in tankers to a milk factory where they are pasteurized and homogenized just for something simple like milk that people take for granted. The process is quite complicated. In the factory, the pasteurization process requires the milk to be heated to 72 degrees Celsius for more than 15 seconds and then immediately cooled. The milk is put under pressure through nozzles, which evenly disperses fat globules. Then, centrifugal separation removes some or all the cream, to make it reduced, low-fat, or skim milk. Ultrafiltration, moves the milk across a membrane under moderate pressure. Reverse osmosis holds back most of the milk solids and only lets water pass through. Ultra osmosis is a combination of ultrafiltration and reverse osmosis, but holds back milk solids and also water and salt to allows water and salt to pass through. Spray drying removes water from the milk to make powdered milk products. Ugh. All that just for you to add some milk to your morning coffee in the morning. The entire process using specific technology that must always be carefully controlled to ensure the health of the product and safety for consumers. Next slide, please. Remote monitoring technologies. Remote monitoring technology gives farmers insight into the health and well-being of their animals. This technology can inform a farmer if their animal is getting sick without having to be in contact with the animal itself, with functions like heat detection identification or stomach acid monitoring. A pedometer function lets you know if the animal needs more exercise. An animal's weight can be taken with walkover scales, and there's technology that can diagnose cattle or swine pregnancy via remote sensors as well. A cow's tail movements can help identify when the animal may be going into labor with monitoring technology. Automated dairy installations. These installations function to allow cows to be milked on their own time. They have the ability to enter in and out of parlors as they please, entering a stall and being milked robotically without any human interaction at all. milk monitoring sensors help monitor the milk quality and check for diseases. Pasture and feeding technologies. Automated feeders play a pivotal role in maintaining an animal's health by feeding mixtures and amounts tailored specifically to that animal's needs. Farmers also have the ability to take their pastures into account with the system through pasture monitoring technologies that identify how much extra feed will be needed based on what is available in the pasture. Automated cleaning systems. No matter the animal, automated cleaning systems are used to remove waste and runoff from animal enclosures and move it to a pile that can be easily moved with machinery. This system helps reduce disease and creates a cleaner environment for the animals. Herd management systems. Herd management systems allow farmers to keep cows fresh and healthy while maximizing milk production. It is a less invasive way to track cows, eliminating the need for branding or tagging. These technologies also decrease the amount of stillborns during pregnancies by 6%. Next slide, please. Remote monitoring technologies. Remote monitoring technology gives farmers insight into the health and well-being of their animals. This technology can inform a farmer if their
Hey, Rebecca. Are you still there? Hello?
I think we lost her.
Yeah, I think so.
There she is. There she is.
What happened? Did it change on your end?
It just stopped.
Died. Oh, that's weird. It kept going for me.
You were at the end anyhow, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, you were at the end of it. Yeah.
We didn't see your references.
Yeah, we didn't see that part.
Okay. Would you like me to put it back on, or?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
Does anyone
have any questions?
Yes, questions.
I have tons, because you're talking, you're in my bailiwick. Besides biochemistry, I'm a genomicist. The word you can't pronounce.
Cool.
Many words I can't pronounce.
But it made sense about the milk, though. You know, allowing only the water and the salt to pass. That's why milk is so watery. Because I used to have the real milk from the actual cow, and it was not the same at all. Just want to say that. But good job, though.
Thank you. There was a lot that I learned during this, because this was not...
Cows are one of the most genetically engineered organisms. And right. With CRISPR-Cas9, you can do so much. Now, I mostly just genetically mutate mice, but yeah, you can do all kinds of things. And of course, we have to use the data analytics to find out what genes we need to edit and how to edit them.
Do you want my mouse? I have one mouse hanging around the house still.
No, I have to start with them when they're a single cell or up to eight cells. I need embryonic stem cells, and then I can change their genotype.
Yeah, I don't have that.
Yeah. It's much, much, much harder to alter a somatic cell, i.e. your physical body, versus an embryonic cell. Now, of course, we are working on viruses that can do that, because there are some that can. We won't get into that.
That's okay. Maybe another time, Landon.
I'm not sure I'm allowed to talk about this stuff.
I don't know. Did anybody have other questions for Rebecca? I don't want to hog up the session.
Good talk.
Yep, good talk. But I guess I didn't see any hands raised, so assuming it's all good. So we have now the next person on our list is Michael. Are you ready?
I am. Let me get going, cool. Get my slides up.
Wonderful, wonderful. Tonight we have a lot of cybersecurity interns doing their presentation, so that's wonderful. It's like, yay.
Want to make sure I get the right window. Let's see. Right. Theme yes. Screen? Yes. Okay. Good afternoon or good evening. My name is Michael Folks. Tonight, I'm going to talk about tabletop exercises and how it can improve your incident response plan. On the agenda is we're going to do an introduction, definition, purpose, key objectives, some of the roles, developing a scenario, how it works, benefits, best practices, and then Q&A. All right, so when we consider the rapid changes in technologies and the related vulnerabilities in those technologies, the current threat landscape with increases in ransomware in these last couple of years, ransomware attacks, and then zero-day vulnerabilities, and just general data breaches, cybersecurity professionals and organizations need to be able to rapidly respond in an effective way to cyber events and incidents. And so tabletop testing is a non-invasive way to do that. There's other ways like red teaming and things like that, but tabletop testing is a non-invasive way to get folks together and discuss how to respond to incidents. So the definitions, I got three definitions for you guys. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency defines tabletop testing as a role-playing activity in which players respond to scenarios. The Center for Internet Security defines it as a means to help organizations consider different risk scenarios, and then the National Institute of Standards and Technology, pretty much the same thing, a discussion-based exercise where key stakeholders can get together and discuss emergence, how to respond to particular emergencies. So the primary purpose is to test and improve the organization's incident response plan, highlight the significance of preparedness in the face of cyber threats, and then help the organization consider different risk scenarios and cyber threats. Some of the key objectives is to evaluate the effectiveness of the response process and procedures, identify areas for improvement by documenting lessons learned. That's critical. Make sure you identify gaps in the document, some of those lessons learned. And then training and familiarizing yourself with key stakeholders within your organization to make sure you're responding to certain protocols in the right way and compliance requirements. So participants in roles, organizations come in a lot of different sizes and shapes. And so you can scale tabletop tests to meet your organizational needs, but some of the standard roles that play a key part in tabletop testing is your security operations lead or team, incident response team or lead, and the IT team lead, and then your program managers. And depending on what type of, I guess, scenario you're testing, you might get your legal folks involved or public relations. And there are also some passive participants in the exercise. Observers do not directly participate in the exercise, however, they may support the development of player responses to situations during the discussion. And then you got the facilitators. They play an important role of keeping each person update to the current situation and moderating the discussion, and they use their expertise to also sort of drill down and identify problem areas that need to be focused on. And then you have note takers, which is there to observe and document the exercise. And they also have a lot of expertise in identifying sort of whether, you know, the primary roles are responding in a way that is conforms to plans, policies, and procedures for the organization. So the scenario, how do you develop the scenario for a tabletop test? The main thing is you want to make it, you want to tailor it for the organization, right? So you want someone that understands the risks, the threats, the vulnerabilities of that organization, and then tailor it around something that's very applicable, if possible, to that organization. Some of the cookie cutter templates that you see out there, you can find is fail patching and how that fail patch may create a denial of service or shut down some type of functionality that's critical to the environment. Malware infections, and then, excuse me, and then cloud compromise. This one is for those organizations that subscribe to a service infrastructure as a service, software as a service, or whatever. You know, how does the organization share in the response for an incident? Does the service provider respond to that incident, or do you, does the organization respond to that incident, or is it shared between the two? So that's a good point to know for your organization. And then how it works. So the best thing is to discuss participants, to discuss the response of the scenario. It's important to state up front that this is, you know, an exercise and it's not going to involve actual changes to the system or the environment. And then participants should think out loud, almost like it's a game, in order to ease tension within the room and allow people to make sure they understand exactly what, you know, some of those key roles are thinking. And tips and tricks is to designate a single individual to facilitate the exercise, facilitate a conversation about how your organization would handle the scenario, focusing on key learning points. And include an applicable member from each business unit. We mentioned that. Be sure to follow up on any gaps identified during the exercise. Think out loud, we mentioned that, and support each other. You know, allow the room to relax, allow folks to explain their expertise in detail and identify any gaps in knowledge that they may have. That's how the entire team grows. So benefits, it improves the incident response capability for the organization. It identifies weaknesses and areas for improvement, enhances communication between the teams, allow team members to get to know one another, understand their key roles, and then determine and clarifies roles. Some of the best practices are clarify objectives and outcomes, choose the right participants. We mentioned that. Design an interactive scenario. It's important to tailor the scenario for the organization. Create an interactive, no-fault space. I think that's crucial, where folks and team members can talk about exactly what they feel their responsibility is. And if, and if that's not clear, then maybe define gaps within within the incident response plan so that that can be addressed later on. So in summary, the tabletop exercise is primarily to allow the organization to improve their incident response plan. It's a non-invasive method set up in a classroom, conference, meeting environment where key roles and key stakeholders can come in and have a full discussion about specific scenarios that's tailored to the environment. And that is all I have. Are there any questions?
Good job, Michael.
Thank you.
So, Michael, so for a small to medium-sized company, what level do you think we would need to do something like this?
I would say for a small to medium-sized company, you typically have a CISO or you have a deputy CISO. They would be involved. You would also have a IT lead. Everyone, small and medium companies have IT lead. They would be involved in it. And then, it depends on sort of what your threat model is. Sometimes, this is a required for compliance, so it's not optional. But small or medium companies that sort of have to fall under like the risk management framework, they got to go through the full incident response tabletop testing on an annual basis. So you can be a small or medium company and still have maybe 5 or 6 key stakeholders that need to participate in this, or you can tailor that down depending on how small the organization is.
Excellent. Charlene, Michael's going to head up the team now for that.
I have I have 2 more weeks, but I'll come back as a GITA member.
Excellent. More better, better, even that.
Yeah, that sounds great. We hold you to it, Michael.
Yes. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Michael, guys? Boy, you guys are really quiet today. All right. All right. So on to the last talk. Christy, are you in?
I'm good to go now.
You're good to go. Okay, yeah. Perfect. Have at it.
Okay. I do want to let everybody know that I am dealing with a bronchitis infection. So if I have to pause for a second, it's because I'm coughing up a lung.
That's okay. That gives us all time to think about what you said.
Yeah, it's okay. It's okay.
Alrighty. You see my screen?
Yes.
Perfect. Alrighty. I would like everyone to take a second to think back to when you woke up this morning. What was the first thing that you guys did? I can almost guarantee most of the responses would be that you checked your phone or scrolled through social media for updates. I know myself, I continuously scroll through Pinterest in the morning before I start my day. sorry. But what we aren't thinking about is what is this doing to our mental health? As I navigate my topic, my goal is not to demonize social media or discourage its use, but to help equip each of us with the knowledge and strategies to use these platforms responsibly and to create a better balance between the two. What is social media? Well, most of us should be pretty well acquainted with social media by now. You've got the YouTube, the Instagram, the TikTok, the Twitter, Facebook, and Pinterest. And who could honestly forget where this all started when MySpace came out? I'm sure many millennials, including myself, remember the big deal that MySpace was back in the day. Having the ability to customize your profile, rate your friends from 1 to 10, of course creating a whole new obsession of checking to see where someone ranks on your friendship. MySpace was a pivotal moment for teenagers and preteens during that time, marking the advent of social media with a bang as it welcomed its first million active users. Following in its footsteps, many other platforms emerged, forever transforming the global dynamics of how we connect and communicate. Social media empowers us to forge connections, cultivate creativity, gain insight, and seize opportunities we might otherwise never encounter. Consider Pinterest, where users can uncover recipes, fitness techniques, and of course, my favorite, which is holiday decor. Then there's Instagram, the virtual canvas for sharing life's moments, from vacations to relationships, events, and even small business adventures. And who could overlook the captivating world of TikTok that has grown so huge over the past couple years, where users craft and share bite-sized videos that last anywhere from 3 seconds to 10 minutes sometimes. And you can find anything from culinary tutorials to workout routines. Each of these platforms offers a unique experience catering to diverse tastes and interests based on its users. So what's the problem? As I previously mentioned, social media provides a wide array of creative avenues for users to stay engaged and well-informed about a wide range of topics. However, we do have to stop and think about our mental well-being. More podcasts and content creators are raising awareness of the toll that mental health takes from excessive amounts of time on social media. Many are experiencing heightened levels of anxiety, depression, addiction, FOMO, which is the fear of missing out, and it's even cultivating digital narcissism. There are also many instances of cyberbullying and addictive behaviors taking place while engaging in social media. Currently, and according to Forbes, as of 2023, there are 4.9 billion users that participate in social media on a global scale. And this number is expected to increase by another billion by 2027. Most users operate on 6 to 7 platforms per month. Currently, the most popular platform is Facebook, with 2.9 million monthly active users. Other platforms that are popular right now are TikTok, Instagram, and YouTube. Did you know that the average person spends 145 minutes on social media per day? That is a lot of hours, even if it doesn't feel like it. Imagine if you were to continue that habit over a lifespan of 73 years. You would have spent 5.7 years on social media platforms alone. That's pretty hefty to me, and in my opinion. Another interesting fact is that half of millennials trust influencers for product recommendations. Social media has increased sales through the recommendations of content creators and influencers. When you go on TikTok or Instagram or even YouTube, there are so many influencers that recommend cleaning products or beauty products, even implement advertisements within their content. A great example is the advertisement for BetterHelp. I know I hear it all the time when I listen to my PlayStation podcast, at the beginning and sometimes midway through. It's easy to listen to someone you trust, especially if they've used the products themselves, and it's a perfect sales pitch. Plus, it benefits the influencers. Most of them end up making profits off of the advertisements that they promote in their content. And if you look on the left, I posted some images of the monthly active users by social media platforms. So you can kind of see how many, like Facebook obviously being the most popular, TikTok is still popular, but it's lesser than compared to Facebook. Then on the upper left, you can see the age ranges of how many people use social media. And obviously, you can see that 18 to 29, 84% of people use social media in that age range, which is pretty interesting. Obviously, followed up by that 30 to 49, and then the rest of the generations that follow after. So what are the benefits of social media? Well, there are many benefits with social media. Some can actually be really life-altering. YouTube has become a way for content creators to enhance their financial status while creating content for their followers that they are passionate about. Instagram has become a place where small businesses have growth opportunities by building their brand and sharing content related to their business. TikTok is a great place to gain inspiration and become aware of current trends or news items. Pinterest is a great place to find creative ideas for your home, hobbies, planner, and articles that are related to your specific interests. Facebook has always been a place for old friends, families, and communities to connect and share content related to their opinions or life and moments. All of these platforms give its users a sense of community, self-esteem boost, and support. Social media also allows users to stay up to date on current events, even create awareness on topics such as mental health or abuse. It is honestly a great way to share information that you are passionate about and find like-minded individuals. Honestly, the world as a whole has become a better place because of social media, since there have been a lot of changes that have come through social media. But with as many benefits, does come some downsides to social media. Too much usage can lead to harmful effects on your mental health. Have you ever had a time where you are on social media looking at your friends' photos or maybe an influencer's photos of their date nights or their vacations or maybe just something that they did on the weekend? How did it make you feel when you got off the platform or even during? I think many of us can say that we felt unfulfilled or uncomfortable with our own stance in our relationship or even our life status. Or maybe you saw your best friend get a promotion and a pay increase when you have not even finished college or you're working at a job that you're just not happy with. This happens to the best of us and almost all the time. Social media has given us a way to connect, but it is also taking away from our mental well-being. 67% of users actually deal with a self-esteem dip while comparing their lives to others that they see. More than 70% of users struggle with FOMO, which is the fear of missing out. And this has become a topic that's been incorporated in more ways than just social media, but definitely the top of social media. It is a way to keep users active and engaged through notifications, content updates, likes, and follows. It leaves users feeling anxious if they are not active in fear that they are missing out on trends or news, follows, messages, opportunities, or just simply missing out on content that's been posted. Cyberbullying is another major problem that's occurred on these platforms and has seen an increase since the pandemic. More people are unhappy than ever before, which has led to users bullying one another on these platforms. This could lead to more depression and anxiety on the receiving end. I know for me, I hear my siblings talk about all the horrible comments that are said, you know, between their friend groups or things that they see online. Other content creators that I listen to even say mention that they get death threats, which is really scary. Social media has led people to using it as a security blanket as well, though. If you ever see people on their phones constantly in social situations, it's because they feel uncomfortable. And that's become the norm now, is where if you're in an uncomfortable social situation, whether that's standing in line, waiting for your food, or maybe you're just hanging out with your friends in a circle, most people choose to sit on their phones because it's where they feel comfortable. Now, how do you know if you're experiencing or suffering from any of these effects? Well, if you're experiencing addiction, you may neglect your daily tasks or family. Your sleep quality may be poor. due to constant notification checking or the urge to check them. Irritability and restlessness may take place if you have not had a chance to get on social media that day. You may feel more anxious or depressed about your own life and accomplishments over time. Many people may participate in risk-taking behavior. I'm sure we all remember the boiling water challenge, or maybe even the Tide Pod challenge. What about the most recent one where influencers demonstrated how to jump off the edge of a boat? Although these may seem like funny ideas, and they gain a lot of attention and popularity, it is important to remember that it's not always a good idea to participate in. It's kind of like the old saying, if your friends all jumped off a cliff, would you do it too? I know my mom told me that a lot as a kid growing up. But my answer is always probably not. These types of behaviors can lead to the development of digital narcissists, which are individuals who have become obsessed with self-promotion through risk-taking behaviors to gain popularity on social media. Digital narcissists will literally do anything to increase their follow numbers or gain attention, even if it makes them truly uncomfortable. According to psychologists, the percentage of digital narcissism has increased to 80% when compared to 30% in the early 2000s. All of these issues are becoming a problem and only increasing as more users jump aboard the social media train. However, it is all treatable and many can undo these challenges they may face. That is why it's important to have mindful consumption. It's always important to remember that social media is an excellent tool and resource when used responsibly. In order to create a healthy balance, it is important to take breaks from your phone or device and replace it with a walk or maybe spending time with loved ones or even doing something else you enjoy. Some people set timers as a reminder when to take breaks because sometimes we need to hear a reminder to register, oh yeah, I've been on my phone for 15, 20 minutes, and I think it's time to get off. If you can try to disable notifications, that will help too. That way you're not tempted to get on your phone or check notifications. Even try leaving your phone in another location while you're sleeping if you feel the urge to check notifications. Now, these incorporations aren't easy, and they do take time to develop into your daily routine. But if you're dedicated, you can definitely make it work and make a giant difference on your mental health. It's really important to develop other hobbies to replace your social media use. For example, I work out, I draw, I play video games, I go for walks, I spend time with my siblings and my fiance, we plan tons of events instead of spending time on social media. I even deleted my social media accounts, I believe it was like 3 or 4 years ago. And I haven't looked back since. And I can say for myself, I genuinely do appreciate a life without social media. I still have my Pinterest. My fiance still does his YouTube. But beyond that, we kind of keep it very minimal. But overall, I do think that everyone could lead a better life if they step outside their digital realm every now and then and just create a good balance between them. And that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Nicely done. I need to do that sometimes, unplug. Any questions for, I forgot who we had. Oh, sorry.
Christy.
All right. Any questions for Christy?
I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
Why so judgy?
Who?
Everyone always says that, but I promise I don't judge. I do not judge at all. Consume as much as you want.
I do that to disappear. Are you kidding? You know how many dings I get?
I hear ya.
Everyone's quiet today. Hardly any questions.
Ready to listen is what it is. Ready to listen and learn.
I guess. So that was the last talk or presentation.
You sure? That was another one after this.
Austin? No. He already did his. Christy wanted to go at the end. So we did go down the line. We had Austin. Kyle did his. Kyle,
Christy, Rebecca, yeah. Nick.
Yeah, Christy wanted to go last, and then Rebecca came in a little later, but
I missed Nick's.
No, yeah, you missed Nick's.
Yeah, you missed it.
He talked about the graphene and not most of the time. That was pretty nice.
Somebody's mic is live.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Yeah. Just me. Okay.
Yeah, just then, watch the video. He doesn't give you all the SP2 orbitals and all the double bonds and all that fun stuff. But,
oh, wow. Yeah.
No.
He missed all that.
He didn't get too technical on that. And then Michael did his, and we elected him to do it.
He's been drafted or voluntold. Yeah.
Yes. Awesome. Right.
He's voluntold. So I told him we'll hold him to it. Yep.
Exactly.
Voluntold.
Well, yeah. I guess
Landon will be over him.
I'm not in cyber. I pop into your knee.
You elected him, so I figured you were the voluntold.
Well, if you're going to give me the authority.
Oh.
All right. So is that an excellent job for everybody?
Yes, they did good. Awesome. So well. Very awesome. Nice. And well, I stayed awake and everything, so that's great.
Thank you. Thank you for taking over for me. We had an orientation, so we got a great team coming in. A couple of my old students. So they know what to do. They've been told.
Cool.
They're ready.
Wonderful.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Thanks for coming, everyone. I hope you clocked in today. I forgot to remind you.
They're all Toodles. Veterans. They should know this.
Yeah.
They will now.
I figured they knew. I saw some of those, you know, on the presentations, you know, where they have that little TCW clock.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I did see that.
I did. Yeah, I saw those little things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks, everybody. Have a good rest of the evening.
Thank you. Have a great day. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to watch it now.
Oh, I guess I can stop recording.
Yeah.
I almost forgot.
Yeah, we're done.